Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the upcoming battle next week in the Senate to decide whether or not to confirm a new Supreme Court justice who has made it clear he wants to give presidents more power, which many people find alarming since Brett Kavanaugh was chosen by a president who is himself under investigation. Lisa Graves, co-director of Documented, who formerly served as Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Justice Department, as Chief of Nominations on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and as a Deputy Chief for the U.S. Courts, joins us to discuss what could emerge from the mountains of emails and documents Democrats are poring over from the long record that Brett Kavanaugh has generated as both a political operative and a federal judge. And although Republican Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell initially advised President Trump not to pick Kavanaugh, the expectation is that all of the Senate Republicans will vote to confirm Kavanaugh, with Vice President Pence as an extra vote if needed. Given that mathematical problem, we'll look into what options the Democrats might have in stopping someone who will move the Supreme Court in an even more right-wing direction, overturning abortion and LGBTQ rights, and what is left of labor and voting rights, to name a few. Then, with the UN issuing a blistering report blaming Saudi Arabia and the UAE for most of the civilian deaths in the war in Yemen, which is finally getting the attention of U.S. lawmakers, we will speak with Ali Alamed, the founder and director of the Institute for Gulf Affairs, an expert on Saudi political affairs and Saudi Arabian relations. He joins us to discuss plans by the Pentagon to train Saudi Arabian military pilots on U.S. soil, and the latest evidence that Saudi Arabia's crown prince, known as MBS, is not the reformer many gullible Western journalists proclaimed him to be. Then finally, we will speak with Eric Loomis, a professor of history at the University of Rhode Island and author of Out of Sight, The Long and Disturbing Story of Corporations Outsourcing Catastrophe, and his latest book just out, A History of America in 10 Strikes. He joins us to discuss his article at the New York Times, Serving Time Should Not Mean Prison Slavery, and the national strike by prisoners underway, which is the largest prison strike in the nation's recent history, aimed at ending forced labor under state coercion, which should be a top priority for the American labor movement to put an end to. And joining us now is Lisa Graves, co-director of Documented, a watchdog group that investigates how corporations manipulate public policy, harming our environment, communities, and democracy. She has served as a senior advisor in all three branches of the federal government, as Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Justice Department, as Chief Counsel for Nominations on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and as a Deputy Chief for the U.S. Courts. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lisa Graves.
Hi, Ian. Thanks so much for having me on.
Well, thank you, Lisa. And you've had unique experience in all three branches of the U.S. government. And so you're very qualified, to my mind, to speak about what might happen next week with Brett Kavanaugh. My understanding is that there's an awful lot of documentation of which the Republicans have resisted, particularly through the National Archives. But as far as I know, they've got enough stuff, if you will, some of which is apparently incriminating. So, two questions. I mean, first of all, it is on the record that Mitch McConnell advised Trump not to pick Kavanaugh simply because he had too much of a record. And two, do you have what's your understanding of what might be in those piles and piles of documents?
Well, you know, I have looked at the nomination process from the inside. I worked on vetting judicial nominees at the Justice Department. That was one of my jobs during the Clinton administration. And then I worked on the Senate Judiciary Committee leading the investigation of the nominees of George W. Bush in his first term, most of it. And then I also had worked at the courts, where I helped train new judges as they were confirmed. And so I've seen it from all three branches. And I have to say that I agree with my former colleague, Christine Lucius, who said that she had never seen a more secretive, corrupt, and troubling process than with Brett Kavanaugh's nomination. when Elaina Kagan, who has been confirmed to the court, was nominated under President Obama, the Senate Judiciary Committee worked on a bipartisan basis to obtain, to request, and receive all of her records. I think they ended up getting 99% of her records. And so far, there's only a very small portion of the records that have been turned over. And in fact, there has not been a cooperation by Senator Grassley of Iowa to request the same set of records for Kavanaugh. And we also know that there's appears to be significant slow walking by the George W. Bush Library and the records folks in terms of turning over materials. And so you have a situation where someone who played an instrumental role in George W. Bush's administration at a time of tremendous controversy during that first term has been nominated. And we know from previous nomination battles that when people are sort of rushed through or pushed through, you can end up with people who you later learn were involved in substantial, seriously controversial issues, like the Ninth Circuit judge who was Jay Bybee, who supervised John Yoo on the torture memos. The public has a right to know these things. And quite frankly, Ian, it's shocking and outrageous for there to be such a rush to try to confirm Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court in such a short period when there's plenty of time to wait and have a full and thorough review of his role in the Bush administration and in other activities, especially after Mitch McConnell and the Republican senators held open a vacancy on the U.S. Supreme Court for more than a year after Justice Scalia died. And that doesn't even get into the whole issue with Trump and his involvement in an ongoing criminal investigation that surrounds him.
Well, that's extraordinary, though, that you have a nominee who's made it clear that he doesn't think presidents have enough power, so he wants to give more power to a president who is under investigation and who might well be guilty of a number of crimes, including money laundering, mob money from Russia, and possibly even being under the control of a hostile foreign power.
That's right. I mean, you have a situation where the special prosecutor for Mr. Mueller and his team have already obtained several plea agreements for criminal conduct by people surrounding the president. Some of his closest advisors have been subject to prosecution or conviction, and you have. There's no doubt that a number of these cases will ultimately be appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court. Certainly, cases involving any assertion of a broad claim of executive privilege, or perhaps, you know, other issues involving obstruction of justice by President Trump or others in his camp, those cases would not go to the Supreme Court. Of course they'll go to the Supreme Court. And it's completely unacceptable in a democratic society for these partisan Republicans to put their party over our country and rush to confirm someone who could very well be the deciding vote in favor of the president, this president, who is in the midst, embroiled in the most serious criminal investigation and series of criminal investigations, I think, ever in the history of the United States and the presidency. And, you know, I think that the American people may not think this is as significant an issue as they head out for Labor Day weekend. But in fact, if Brett Kavanaugh is confirmed, he'll not only preside potentially over cases that could exonerate President Trump. And as you said, Ian, he's on the record for basically suggesting that a sitting president can't be held to account for his activities or misconduct through the court, through a prosecution. But also, Brett Kavanaugh is a relatively young man, and he could be on the Supreme Court for the next 30 or even 40 years, cementing an extreme right-wing corporate court that has as its mission to strip away longstanding protections for ordinary citizens, including expanding cases like Citizens United and further protecting corporations and the wealthy from transparency laws and more. And so, you know, it affects not just our democracy, but also issue after issue, whether it's reproductive rights, whether we'll have the ability as a democratic people to pass laws to address the climate changes that are underway, obviously manifest in California out there, and across the nation, but worldwide, And Brett Kavanaugh has a record on the bench and beyond as a member of the Federal Society as someone who's hostile to the power of the EPA to execute the wishes of the American people to address these climate changes that are causing and causing and helping create the tinderbox for the devastating fires that have hit California, for expanded pollution by the oil industry and more. And so these issues aren't just abstract issues in D.C. They're issues that ultimately will affect everybody's life in America and our ability as a free people to pass laws to govern these corporations and these corporate activities.
And again, I'm speaking with Lisa Graves, who's co-director of Documented, a watchdog group that investigates how corporations manipulate public policy, harming our environment, communities, and democracy. She has served as a senior advisor in all three branches of the federal government, as deputy assistant attorney general in the Justice Department, as chief counsel for nominations on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and as a deputy chief for the U.S. courts. Now, it's my understanding, Lisa, that the point that you made earlier, that the Republicans have been unprecedented in their resistance to turning over documents, and they've been slow walking the Bush presidential library. Grassley is doing everything he can to obstruct getting the record out about Kavanaugh, particularly his work as a political operative, Grassley, being in charge of the Judiciary Committee, demanded all of that documentation for Elena Kagan, as you pointed out. So a double standard, I guess, is not a surprise, given what the Republicans did to Merrick Garland and Barack Obama. And the reason that Trump is able to fill the Supreme Court, fill the federal judiciary in an unprecedented record way with so many unqualified judges is because Mitch McConnell not only held up Merrick Garland for the Supreme Court, but he also held up most of Obama's nominees. So there was a big backlog when Trump came in. So that's the context, the broader context. But my understanding is that there are some, even within what they've managed to find, there are some incriminating documents and emails that suggest that this nominee, Brett Kavanaugh, who was so zealous in going after Bill Clinton and so obsessed with the prurient details of Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky's sexual activities, that almost like a kind of scold from the days of the Salem witch trials, he himself is not pure as the driven snow, that there are rumors that he has a drinking problem, he's a womanizer, and he has a gambling problem. So if that stuff is able to emerge, do you think it'd make any difference with the Republicans?
Well, given the record, the track record of the GOP in Alabama and other places, it's hard to imagine what their test for character is, quite frankly. You know, in terms of Brett Kavanaugh and his personal history, certainly this baseball thing seems like an oddity and an unusual circumstance. When you say incriminating, I think more in the sense of imputing to him, what is the character of a man who would write the types of things that he wrote that President Clinton should be questioned about when he was working for Ken Starr to pursue that affair with Monica Lewinsky? Those questions are quite pointed and in fact shocking in some ways. And yet he turns around when Bush becomes president and beyond. To suggest that actually other presidents should not be held to account or subject to prosecution. And so he's someone who seems to have a double standard, to say the least, in terms of the case law or the powers of the Justice Department to enforce the law. And in that case, that particular case involved not a violation of federal law. It involved a case involving sexual harassment that then spread to include these other issues. Actually, that started as an entirely other case. But leaving all that aside, I think when you look at Kavanaugh, what you see is someone who is a very political person. He's someone who has been trained as a political operative, though he's been a judge for the last couple of years, nearly a decade. He's someone who was being groomed for the bench, groomed to be an ideologue on the court. And so we'll see what comes out in terms of his personal background, despite the sort of spin around him just being a good carpooling dad or something. The reality is that he's not just a carpooling dad, and the test for the courts isn't whether you're smart or whether you can drive a car, but whether you're fair. And I think on almost every point, Kavanaugh fails the test of being fair and impartial, that you would get a fair shake before him. You know, when you look at the history of nominations, and it was Senator Sessions, surprisingly, perhaps, that joined with Senator Leahy in seeking those materials about Elena Kagan when Sessions was the chairman and ranking member when he was on the Judiciary Committee and led that role before Grassley. But in fact, there's precedent for that sort of care for the Judiciary Committee to take to try to make sure that there's a complete record before someone is given a lifetime job on the highest court in our country. It's not always followed, so the Republicans are extremely hypocritical on nominations. And as you point out, Senator McConnell was sort of not the mastermind, but the architect of really slowing down and trying to obstruct President Obama from getting his nominees through. And though many nominees got through, many were blocked, leaving Trump this enormous sort of set of vacancies for him to fill. And he has, as in every other thing that he does, routinely chosen the wrong person for the job. Incompetent, unqualified people, bloggers, people who have very little judicial experience, people who don't have records of fairness. But that's sort of par for the course for Trump when you're looking at his administration. He chooses people who appear to be corrupt or are corrupt, who aren't that smart, who are sycophants. He, when given two choices, sort of two roads diverging in the wood, it seems as though Trump will always choose the wrong person for the job. And I think in this instance, it's not just a temporary position in his corrupt administration that someone is getting, whoever he puts forward to the bench. It's people who are being given lifetime jobs for decades to preside over the rest of us. And some of these people are manifestly unfit. McConnell knows that, but he doesn't care because he's a party hack and willing to do whatever is necessary to advance his party's interests. His party's interests are really corporate and right-wing interests. He's not interested in a fair judiciary. He's interested in having the most biased judiciary he can obtain.
So, but surely, if it turns out that Kavanaugh has a gambling problem with sports betting, that seems to be a serious thing for a judge, surely. You know, you don't want the book.
I mean, you know,
if the bookie is the mafia, for God's sake. I mean, you know, this is what's extraordinary. I mean, Brian Fallon, who used to up until recently, was the chief spokesman for Chuck Schumer, said today, Mitch McConnell is in the middle of stealing the federal courts for conservatives, and Democrats continue to bring a butter knife to a gunfight. Democrats should be resisting Trump's judge picks at every turn, not agreeing to fast-track them, as happened this week. It's hard to think of a more pathetic surrender heading into the Kavanaugh hearings. Now, my understanding is that the real problem is Schumer himself, along with Senator Feinstein, that they have made the calculus that this fighting Kavanaugh and revealing what they know about him will backfire on the vulnerable Democratic senators Heidi Heitkamp, Joe Manchin, and Claire McCaskill. So they're apparently willing to let Kavanaugh go through. And, you know, Schumer, I think, is a total disgrace. And the last person who should be the majority leader of the Democrats. And apparently, Feinstein is so mad at the Democratic left because of how she's been treated here in California and hasn't gotten the endorsement of the California Democratic Party. So she's going to stick it to the progressive political left by supporting Kavanaugh. That's my understanding of what's really going on there.
Oh, my goodness. Well, on the first point you raised in terms of if there were a gambling problem, if Kavanaugh has that issue, it certainly would raise significant concerns about what's known as blackmailability. You know, one of the things that happens with these judges is they have extraordinary power to make rulings to affect the outcome of cases. And if someone has an issue like that in their background, they would be unlikely to get cleared for just a regular job at the Justice Department. They shouldn't be in a position of power where their activities, if that's what's happening, could be used against them by someone who's appearing before the court who wants to influence them. Sort of standard goes for both the executive branch and the judicial branch. You have a person in the White House right now who actually probably couldn't get clearance for any job in the entire federal government, other than the fact that he's been elected to the White House. But he is clearly someone who has a lengthy track record and could easily be under foreign influence, as the evidence appears to suggest. But in terms of this question of Senator Schumer and Senator Feinstein, I'm not in those meetings and I don't know. But I would say to you that what the former spokesman said is pretty accurate in most regards, because, quite frankly, what's the plus? What's the incentive to fast track a number of other Trump nominees? What does the Democratic leadership get out of that at this point? It's further packing of the court. I'm not sure that the negotiating strategy makes any sense at all. And certainly this idea that you've got to protect Joe Manchin at all costs, or that you've got to protect Heidi Heitkamp at all costs, even to the detriment of the future jurisprudence, the future judicial rulings of the United States for decades to come, just doesn't make any sense at all on any ordinary person's calculus. The courts are more important than some seat in West Virginia, quite frankly. I don't think that that's a fair calculus to the American people, who care very much about what this court is going to rule for the next generation, for the rest of the lifetimes of most of the people probably listening to this show, is far more important than some Senate seat in West Virginia and whether Joe Manchin holds it or not. And quite frankly, if Democrats like Joe Manchin were actually talking about the issues about what's really happening in America and how Trump is screwing everyone over and how this nomination would further screw people over, quite frankly, by putting another corporatist on the court, then maybe he wouldn't be having such a hard time.
Well, Lisa Graves, I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Ian. Thank you so much.
And again, I'll be speaking with Lisa Graves, co-director of Documented, a watchdog group that investigates how corporations manipulate public policy, harming our environment, communities, and democracy. She has served as a senior advisor in all three branches of the federal government, as deputy assistant attorney general in the Justice Department, as chief counsel for nominations on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and as a deputy chief for the U.S. courts. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into how the UN has issued a blistering report blaming Saudi Arabia and the UAE for most of the civilian deaths in the war in Yemen. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Ali Alamed, who's the founder and director of the Institute for Gulf Affairs and a scholar and expert on Saudi political affairs, including terrorism, Islamic movements, Wahhabi Islam, Saudi political history, Saudi-American relations, and the Al Saud family history. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ali Alamed.
Thank you very much.
So, Ali, the the UN recently issued a very critical report blaming Saudi-UA military coalition for most of the civilian deaths in Yemen's war. We, of course, saw the pictures of a bus full of children that was targeted by Saudi Arabian Air Force and wedding parties. I mean, the evidence is overwhelming. Why has it taken American officials so long to speak out?
Well, the American officials have been involved in the war. I mean, I had discussions with the State Department during the Obama administration, and you know, they admitted that they knew ahead of the war that the war is happening, and they were involved in it. The United States is involved, but it's so ashamed of its role, it's not willing to come forward and come forth with its exact involvement. Last week, the Yemeni caught on video in daylight American or U.S. Fuel tankers fueling the airplanes that bombed Yemeni civilian targets and killed 31 women and children. And it doesn't seem to make any difference for the American officials or the military. And I think what they have been doing, saying since the Obama administration, that's what they told me, that, oh, we are trying to minimize civilian targets, and we are helping them to minimize collateral damage. It's been going on for 3 years. And what they have been doing, they're using this cover to continue to appear that they are, they care, but in the same time, they're doing exactly the opposite, where they are pushing and helping and encouraging, in fact, this war by selling the Saudis limitless amount of weaponry. And that's very clear. And so words really do not, I think they're using this as a fig leaf to say that we don't know, we're not sure. Those bombs are Americans, and the reconnaissance is American. There is, in fact, and this is information, there is a team. It has been always there before the war started. There is an American and British teams, military teams, inside the command and control of the Saudi Air Force and the war room in Saudi Arabia. It's in a basement in Riyadh. And there are equipment, American equipment, that is connected to the headquarters of the Central Command in Florida. And they exchange information, and the American officers print those things, and they are doing it this way to avoid detection, and so they are printing that information, giving it to the Saudis, and handing it to there is a person who basically goes back and forth between the two sides for the targeting. So they are in intimately involved in the targeting and reconnaissance and guiding. And military airplanes, American military airplanes, have landed in Yemen with taking journalists on behalf of the Saudis and the Emiratis. So they are, the United States and the UK are both involved. In fact, I have evidence and indications of British private pilots flying UAE and Saudi planes and doing some of those bombings.
And this is Yemen is the poorest country in the Arab world, and the UN has described the situation in Yemen as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. That ought to get people's attention.
I don't think it has. It started, unfortunately, Ian. We live in the world where the powerful can do whatever they want. If I wrote about this in 2014, when the war in 2015, when the war started. How the UN Security Council illegally supported this war. This was not nothing that just came. So it was planned. The UN Security Council pushed through an illegal resolution 2216 that actually contradicts its own charter, but nobody cared. The UN has no right to appoint somebody as the president of a country. And they did that. They violated their own resolutions and their own charter. But, and this was during the Obama administration, mind you, not the Trump. So this is nothing, it's not really on Trump alone. Unfortunately, this is the policy. And they have supported this war. It is, there is, I think, some bigoted stance here. The fact that let these Arabs kill each other, we'll give them the weapons, we'll support that, we'll support one side, and we will claim that we care about human rights. And this is the policy, the American and the British policy. This is beyond hypocrisy, honestly. Without U.S. and U.K. support, the military, the political support, this war will have ended a long time ago.
And again, I'm speaking with Ali Alamed, who's the founder and director of the Institute for Gulf Affairs and a scholar and expert on Saudi political affairs, including terrorism, Islamic movements, Wahhabi Islam, Saudi political history, Saudi-American relations, and the Al-Saud family history. So there's a report out today that the Pentagon wants to train Saudi pilots on U.S. soil, and they're soliciting contractors, pilots familiar with the F-15s. I thought that the Saudis pilots had been trained in the United States for some time. Is this a new thing that's going on?
It's not a new thing, but I think what they're trying to do is to basically, again, use these tactics to say, oh, look, we're doing something. They are trying to change the subject instead of coming forward. And, you know, I'm so dismayed at the media. I mean, I wrote to a Pentagon reporter for one of the wires, and I said, here's the video of the plane. Why don't you ask them about it? This is a huge thing. Unfortunately, the media in the United States has not been willing to challenge the administration narrative on Yemen, and nobody's asking these questions. They ask about a video or a tweet, but they are not willing to ask about the greatest or the largest humanitarian crisis in the world. And this is very disturbing in itself. They are willing, you know, so you see what I mean, that they are ignoring America's role in this catastrophe, this atrocity, but they are willing to keep us busy about things that are really very small in terms of if you compare the two.
Well, indeed, the executive director for Human Rights Watch's Middle East North Africa division, Sarah Whitson, said that the Saudi pilots have shown a reckless disregard for human life in the countless atrocities they've caused in Yemen at this point. We need accountability for war crimes, not more training. That's given that this is MBS's war, and he's Mohammed bin Salman is the crown prince, but he's effectively the king. He's being groomed as a king. I believe the king himself has Alzheimer's. I think there's an awful lot more going on between the Trump administration and the Saudis. We know that the Saudis have a de facto alliance now with Israel. They have, the Saudis put on a big show for Trump. He'd never seen so much gold. You know, he has a lot of phony gold in his buildings, but he was blown away by how much gold they really have. But my understanding is that for all of this investigation into Russian links to the election of Donald Trump, that there may actually be more links in terms of money and money laundering into the Trump campaign from Saudi Arabia and the Emirates. Do you know anything about that?
Well, the Gulf countries, all of them, have been involved in American elections for maybe decades. And I remember in 2004, we got information about how the Saudis paid John Edwards $300,000 through this real estate deal, this suspicious real estate deal. John Kerry will not criticize the Saudis, and so you are looking at decade long funding of American elections, not only the presidential elections. And the FBI and Mueller, it was Mueller at the time, they didn't do anything about it. They didn't have investigation or special counsel. In this last election, presidential election, Bill Clinton and George W. Bush met with King Salman in September of 2015, and they got money for their, respective
foundations.
Not foundations.
They're libraries.
Candidates, yeah. For the candidates for Hillary.
Oh, really?
And for Jeb Bush. but nobody's willing to investigate it. So you are looking at this is not the first time that they got tens of millions of dollars for the library or for the foundation, and sometimes they do it through these deals, sometimes directly, but it has never really raised an eyebrow legally with anyone, and it continues to happen. With John McCain got $1 million from the Saudi embassy for his McCain Institute, and nobody really cared. So if it's Saudi Arabia, it's okay. If it's the UAE, it's okay. But if the Russians, if you meet a Russian, it's a big deal. It's an unfortunate, you know.
So right.
It's not about the law. It's about who you like and you don't like.
Right. Well, you know, I talked to a Pentagon source off the record. He said that everybody in the Pentagon, all the way up to Mattis, is really alarmed. And Mattis, General Mattis, by the way, the Secretary of Defense, has been marginalized. Trump doesn't talk to him anymore because he only wants sycophants around him, like Pompeo and Bolton. And they're worried that if Mueller closes in on Trump and indicts members of the Trump or Kushner family, that the bombs are going to fall, probably on Iran. So that is a big fear. We're going to have a little wag the dog war, or even a big wag the dog war. But MBS, of course, wants America, as does Netanyahu, to go to war on their behalf, don't they? They want them to go to war against Iran rather than the Saudis and the Israelis take on Iran.
But I think there is another a plan to start another war, because that keeps the American arms manufacturers happy, and it creates job, and that's what everybody cares about. They don't care about the destruction of the Middle East or the death of Arab and Muslim people. As long as it's making job and those companies can make weaponry, and they don't care. You're talking about that. That's what I said. That the view that those brown people do not deserve more than that. You know, they can fight each other, and then we can celebrate the sales of weaponry, and that has been the post-colonial view of the Middle East by the UK and the United States, and it has never stopped. That's why you see the U.S. and the U.K. involved in many wars in the Middle East over the past 30 years, either by encouraging or funding and even getting involved. And I wish one day I would be able to write about this to see how much damage and devastation that region would have been in much better condition if these wars were not encouraged and funded and supported.
So let's, in the last couple of minutes, turn to Mohammed bin Salman, MBS, the Crown Prince. You know, people like Tom Friedman, the New York Times, were very flattered by him and thought he was a great reformer. And it turns out that he's jailing political opponents, mostly liberals. He's doing the most disgraceful, punitive action of beheading a Saudi woman activist and jailing women at the same time taking credit for allowing women to drive. How gullible do you think Western journalists have been in this obvious PR gullible campaign?
They're not gullible. They know what they are spreading falsehood, and they are probably getting paid for it. So they know. They're not stupid. But people, I mean, we have cases where we know that people said nice things, and it turns out that it was, they were paid for it. And I would not rule that out. I mean, I probably going to do something on this specific issue myself, using the information we have. I'm not going to preempt it. But if you see an American and Western journalist or a newspaper applauding and praising Mohammed bin Salman, it's very suspicious. It's not sincere. There is something going on. And again, I think where is the FBI? Where is the investigation? Because this is illegal, supposedly. Where is the New York Times board? Where are the newspapers? And where 60 Minute editors and CBS editors. I mean, they should have looked at this. This is it was a shame for journalism to do such thing for the 60 Minutes or whatever Friedman wrote. It was really a disaster for American journalism.
Right, but at the end of the day, though, I don't believe the New York Times is taking money from the Saudis. But
not the paper, the person.
But okay, well, even Friedman himself, I'm not sure about that. But I would think that at the end of the day, when our own president, the president of the United States, is so much enthralled with
human.
Yeah, I mean,
human, yeah.
I think you have to put the blame right at the top, which is the
absolutely
relationship between President Trump and MBS.
What you have is you had American presidents and even British prime ministers taking money. So why wouldn't a journalist from whatever newspaper do the same?
Well, Ali Ahmed, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much. Thank you, sir.
And again, I've been speaking with Ali Ahmed, the founder and director of the Institute for Gulf Affairs and a scholar and expert on Saudi political affairs, including terrorism, Islamic movements, Wahhabi Islam, Saudi political history, Saudi-American relations, and the Al Saud family. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back looking into the national prison strike underway.
Bet I'd move it farther, a little farther down the line, far from Folsom Prison. That's where I want to stay. And I'd let that lonesome whistle blow my blues away.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24-7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Eric Loomis, a professor of history at the University of Rhode Island, who blogs at Lawyers, Guns, and Money on labor and environmental issues. He is the author of Out of Sight, The Long and Disturbing Story of Corporations Outsourcing Catastrophe, Empires of Timber, Labor Unions, and the Pacific Northwest Forests. And his latest book just out is A History of America in 10 Strikes. And he has an op-ed at the New York Times, Serving Time Should Not Mean Prison Slavery. Welcome to Background Briefing, Eric Loomis.
Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you, Eric. And as we approach Labor Day, you make the point in your article in the New York Times that getting rid of prison slavery should be the top priority for the American labor movement. So give us your understanding of where American labor stands on this issue of prison slavery.
Right. So, you know, Americans think that slavery ended in 1865 at the end of the Civil War, but that's not true. The 13th Amendment to the Constitution has an exception for people who are imprisoned. And almost immediately after the Civil War, Southern states especially began to use that to coerce black labor to serve white interests for no money, for no payment. And that has effectively continued until today and is still a huge issue and is the major cause of this prison strike. The American labor movement has really not had much of an answer to this ever because for a couple of reasons. One is that the American labor movement has never really showed a lot of interest in organizing prisoners. And for another, it's very difficult to organize prisoners. You know, the American labor movement is primarily concerned with organizing paid workers into unions. And, you know, how do you organize prisoners into a labor movement is a real challenge. And what that has left is this enormous sector of American labor that is unorganized and is almost as exploited as they were under the conditions of actual chattel slavery in America before the Civil War.
So since August the 21st, prisoners across the U.S. and Canada have been on this largest prison strike in the nation's recent history. Tell us about their demands.
Sure. I mean, the central demand is the end of unpaid labor. I mean, there are other there are other demands. I mean, you know, the condition of prisoners in this country is almost impossible for non-prisoners to imagine. It's a level of exploitation that is almost unbelievable, and yet has affected millions of people, or at least at some time in their lives, particularly people of color. And yet, you know, it really is a non-issue in American politics. Even in American left politics, there have been people such as Angela Davis, the famed civil rights activist, who have made prison reform a central part of their plank for decades, but it's never really quite caught on. But central to the life of prisoners is this forced labor. People, for instance, the California wildfires right now that are destroying so much of the state, prisoners make up a huge part of that firefighting labor force, and they are almost unpaid for that. They make a sheer pittance. And what this means is that, you know, they have no real control over their lives, over their work lives, which is a central part of any labor movement, that workers should be able to control their lives. And they don't really have the ability to say no to this kind of labor. And if you can't say no, I'm not going to do a certain kind of labor, and you are in a situation where you're not going to get paid for that type of labor, that is what is called slavery.
And this is, of course, the states, and California is a blue state and considered to be considerably more advanced, if you will, than, say, Alabama and Louisiana. In Louisiana, prisoners are paid 4 cents an hour. There are up to 800,000 prisoners a day working without, you know, not voluntarily. So give us a sense of... there's that famous prison, Angola, right, in Louisiana. Mm-hmm. That's a huge operation, isn't it?
Sure. I mean, the prison industrial complex in this country is huge. It's grown much larger over the last few decades, and perhaps worst of all, it's been privatized. And throughout this whole history, from really the late 19th century all the way to the present, you know, businesses or other economic operations, a cotton farm in 1920 Louisiana or some corporation today, has looked at prison labor as an alternative to paid labor, because ultimately the goal of corporations is to pay as little as possible. And, you know, one of the reasons why prison labor should be, you know, this effectively slave labor in prison should be a concern to all of us, is that with so many Americans in the injustice system, that it has a serious downward effect on wages for all Americans, because corporations and different economic entities, you know, if they can, will use prison labor at these 4 cents an hour in Louisiana rather than paid labor making even a minimum wage in the United States. And so this is really, it should be a concern to all Americans.
And again, I'm speaking with Eric Loomis, a professor of history at the University of Rhode Island, who blogs at Lawyers, Guns, and Money on labor and environmental issues. He's the author of Out of Sight, The Long and Disturbing Story of Corporations Outsourcing Catastrophe, Empire of Timber, Labor Unions and the Pacific Northwest Forests. And his latest book just out is A History of America in 10 Strikes. And he has an op-ed at the New York Times, Serving Time Should Not Mean Prison Slavery. So since the nationwide prison strike in the U.S. and Canada has been going on since August the 21st. Give us an update on where they are and whether anybody is listening to their demands.
Well, you know, this kind of organizing is incredibly difficult, and prisoners exist in effectively black boxes with an almost a total inability to communicate with one another without the basic civil or human rights that the rest of us outside of prison would expect. And so widespread organizing is extremely difficult to accomplish. So it's not as if, you know, all prisons across the country are engaging in this, although it has spread relatively far. What has been very successful, and I think really beyond what might have been expected, is that it has gotten a significant amount of media attention. There has, especially in the last, say, 4 to 5 days of this action, there has been multiple op-eds, including, of course, my own, various articles in a wide variety of publications, including elite publications, not only the New York Times, but the Washington Post and the Atlantic and other places. And so I think what this strike has really accomplished, and it's really probably all it could possibly expect to accomplish, is raising the consciousness of this issue with Americans who might care. Because the reality is the prisoners are basically flushed down the toilet of our nation. They're stripped of their rights. And then even, you know, well-thinking liberal or left people sort of forget about them. And so this is a situation where millions of people are in a, you know, very unjust system. And raising the awareness of this has been a big success. Now, you know, ultimately what's going to need to happen is that the awareness from this needs to extend to things like legislation and regulatory policy and other things to change the actual lives of prisoners. So this is, we can consider this hopefully a first step towards some concrete changes that make the lives of prisoners less like actual slaves.
Well, the Gulag system, the first Gulag was Australia, where the British sent their prisoners. But Stalin created a massive gulag, and what he did was essentially make everything illegal, literally. You know, the bread trucks would arrive at 4 a.m. and just arrest people wholesale. And obviously there were a lot of political prisoners and liberals and poets and writers and anybody that Stalin didn't like. Were hauled off and sent into Siberia, and they literally worked and built infrastructure, and that was a cynical, really a disgraceful, horrible, cynical way to basically use cheap labor, not cheap beyond belief, to get for state purposes, and so I'm wondering whether there's a connection here between the fact that the United States has the highest prison population in the world per capita and they are exploiting these prisoners as cheap labor. Is there a connection there between our high rate of incarceration and the exploitation of prison labor?
Oh, absolutely. And I think it's not much less cynical than Stalin, because the difference is that in the United States, the vast majority of this labor is people of color, right? It's African Americans, which I focused on in the article because of the long history of this, but it's also Latinos, it's also Native Americans, it's also Vietnamese Americans. It's people of color across the board are incarcerated at very high rates. And there's a long history in this nation of demanding that people of color labor for white people for free. I mean, if you look, for instance, at Native Americans, which, you know, we don't talk about very much, there's Native American slavery going on in the American West well after the Civil War into the 1880s. There are Native Americans who are effectively slaves of white masters. And this is not something that is talked about very much. And so in many ways, this prison labor system is just a continuation of this. It's a cynical effort to control black and black population, but also the population of other people of color, force them to labor for white interests at incredibly low or non-existent wages, and effectively build a capitalist infrastructure that creates profit in a way that's not all nearly as different from what Stalin did in the Gulag as we would like to think.
So what's going to get the American people involved in this? Because obviously, out of sight, out of mind, you know, people don't want to think about, you know, our enormous prison population. At least they don't. It's not something that's caught on. The fact that they've been able to privatize prisons, and we've seen that, by the way, with this inhumane immigration policies on the border, where they've been separating kids from their parents. They suddenly, it's a boom town for contractors to build more private prisons for immigrants. So it's, you know, I mean, that's a horrible situation, but I guess it's too late to correct it. Although I think there have been some efforts in some states to do away with private prisons. That, to me, would be the first place to start. What, given this strike underway in the prisons in this country, what do you think the priorities should be?
Well, I think that getting rid of private prisons is an excellent idea. I mean, I think that we're at a moment, you know, we're at a moment right now, I think, in American history where the power of neoliberalism in both the Republican and Democratic Party is finally beginning to crest. I think that you're seeing the way that the Democratic Party is moving since November of 2016 is toward a much more robust public sector. people talking about leftist ideas within the Democratic Party in a way that has not been seen since the 1970s. And I think that, it takes time for that to build, but I think we're about to see a new generation of activists and politicians responding to those activists who are going to reinvigorate the public good. And part of that's going to be, I think, pushing back against private prisons. It is, however, going to take time. I think that the top priority, right now, may well should be the end of private prisons. I think another key priority should be that all prisoners should be making at least the minimum wage in the given state. And I think that that's something that the labor movement should get behind. I think that's something that every activist should get behind, because, again, widespread prison labor undermines wages and negotiating opportunities for free labor. And that has been something that capitalists have been able to use since the beginning of American history to divide the labor movement, to divide workers by race, and to consolidate power over workers. If we look at why the United States never really had the leftist tradition of European nations, the biggest reason is that the American working class was divided by race. And so I think that creating policies that begin to fight that, such as a minimum wage for all prisoners that equals a state minimum wage, would be an excellent beginning for that. But I absolutely agree with you that the end of private prisons would be an enormous benefit and would allow for more pressure to be placed upon the prison system to treat prisoners with a basic modicum of human rights.
And is there, just in closing, is there a face to this rebellion? Is there somebody that I could interview, for example, that's leading the prison strike?
It's mostly people on the outside. I mean, I think there are people who have been working on these prison issues for decades, who are still working on it. But those who are organizing it from the inside, they're using, hidden cell phones,
right,
and things of this nature. This is a very underground movement. And I think it's remarkable that people have paid this much attention to it, because it is such an underground movement.
Sure. By the way, in closing, the prison phone system, which is their only way to communicate with the outside world and their families, they're exploited terribly on that as well. And we just learned that one of the big contractors who does prison phones was recording all of the conversations between prisoners and their lawyers. So they seem to be exploited at every turn, don't they, prisoners?
Absolutely. It's a terrible life to be a prisoner, and millions and millions of Americans have experienced this.
Well, Eric Loomis, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Eric Loomis, who's a professor of history at the University of Rhode Island, who blogs at Lawyers, Guns, and Money on labor and environmental issues. He's the author of Out of Sight, The Long and Disturbing Story of Corporations Outsourcing Catastrophe, Empires of Timber, Labor Unions and the Pacific Northwest Forests. And his latest book just out is A History of America in 10 Strikes. And he has an op-ed at the New York Times, Serving Time Should Not Mean Prison Slavery. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Martz. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.